Next case is 206-374, Cheryl Clark et al. Versus James Scarpelli. Mr. Trimble.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Tom Trimble, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Cheryl Clark. I'd like to reserve, Your Honor, about 3 to 5 minutes before the
watch. You need to watch your clock, your time on the clock.
Please, the court, counsel. This case involves, quite simply, a relatively straightforward analysis of an auto insurance policy written by Mid-Century, and the question is whether Mid-Century, as it is obligated to do under Ohio law, clearly and unambiguously limited the wrongful death beneficiary claims to a single per person limit. We believe it did not. We believe that this policy on its face is ambiguous. The various portions of this policy are ambiguous. And even if the separate portions of the policy are analyzed in pari materia, as was done by the court below, that there are still inherent inconsistencies and ambiguities in the policy, and therefore the per occurrence limits should apply to the various claims of the wrongful death beneficiaries. There are a number of things that both parties agree on. Each of the beneficiaries has a separate claim for damages, and they can only be subject to a per-person limit in the event that the policy clearly, concisely, and unambiguously limits those claims, those various beneficiaries' claims, to the per-person limit. 3937.18a allows insurance companies, in that amendment, to limit such claims, but they must limit them in a way that's clear and unambiguous. The Mid-Century policy tries to do this through a combination of the definitional section of bodily injury, of an additional definitional section with regard to the definition of who is an insurer, and then the limitation of liability section. These are separate sections of the policy, and they do not, in and of themselves, limit these claims to a per-person limit. The ambiguity arises in a number of ways. First off, in the additional definition section, which is under uninsured motorist 1C, which the appellee relies upon, the policy defines an insurer to include any person for damages, that person is entitled to recover because of bodily injury to you, a family member, or another occupant of the insured car. This language is critical, as has been established in a number of cases, Schroeder, Cincinnati versus Phillips, Newsom, and Atkinson, to name a few. The wrongful death beneficiaries of Shane Parker did sustain damage, do have damages, because of bodily injury. Therefore, they are covered parties for damages under the terms of this policy. If you look at the limitations section, however, Your Honors, you will see that the limit for, quote, each person is the maximum for bodily injury. That's the critical portion of this policy that the appellee relies upon and the court below relied upon. The siblings and parents of the decedent in this case did not suffer a bodily injury. they do not have claims under Ohio law for bodily injury. Therefore, their aggregate claims, under the very clear meaning, the plain meaning of this policy, we believe, Your Honors, cannot be limited to the single person limit. If you just look at that portion of their attempt to limit these claims.
Counselor, we've read the briefs, and usually we don't ask for a recitation of the facts because we understand them. But in these cases, the facts are always so important because of the multiple claimant problem. This was a single car accident.
Correct.
Two passengers.
Correct.
One of them killed.
Well, actually, there were additional passengers that aren't relevant here, but one of them was killed.
Well, it doesn't say that in the brief. I guess that's why I think we need to know that. Scarpelli was the driver of the vehicle, and Matthew Allen and Shane Parker were passengers. That's not exclusive?
No, you're exactly right, Your Honor. Two passengers and a driver.
Okay. Parker was killed.
Correct.
Was Matthew Allen injured?
He was injured.
Did any of the distributions of proceeds go to him?
No. The distribution of the proceeds, the single per-person limit of the applicable liability policy carried by the at-fault driver of State Farm, which is instructed, by the way, was distributed among the wrongful death beneficiaries of Mr. Parker.
Okay. Well, let's just assume then, for purposes of this discussion, that the language of resulting from or caused by or all those nuances in these policies are not going to carry the day, the language distinctions. Why would you not argue 3937.18A2, amount available for payment?
We did argue that, Your Honor, in our brief. The amicus brief
But not very long.
That's a very good point. We do think that is probably the second or third argument. This policy is so clearly ambiguous, however.
Okay, now let's go back to the facts, because when you get to that, we need to know that. You want to talk about the language again, but I want to know just about the policies. The tortfeasor had a policy. The negligent Scaparelli had a policy, right?
Correct.
Okay. That policy, the total proceeds of that policy were paid out to X and Y, or at least Y.
Correct.
Now, there are what, three other policies, each with 100, 300, that you're trying to access?
No, there are only a total, Your Honor, of two auto policies involved here. One is a State Farm policy that insured the driver at fault, Scarpelli.
And the limits for that were paid?
The limits for the death claim were paid in the amount of the per-person limit of $100,000, which was distributed among the beneficiaries of the deceased.
Okay.
In some, you know, allocation.
Now, the policies we're looking at, or you're trying to access, or what?
The uninsured, underinsured policy carried by the deceased's family. His mother was the named insurer, Cheryl Clark. It is their UIM policy that's at issue here today with Mid-Century.
And there was just one? This case, it only had one. I guess the next case, one of them has three. But this one just has the 100-300 policy.
That's correct.
And so the argument would be, among others, that the tortfeasor had 100, this policy's 100, matching limits, no coverage.
Well, the response to that is the amount available argument, which is just...
That's where I'm going.
Exactly. The amount available or the amount recovered, either way you want to call it, was in fact less than the available per person limit to each of the wrongful death beneficiaries.
Okay, so to access the full 100,000, because that's all that's left in this case, is one policy of 100,000. If you accept the Senate Bill 20 amendment and 3937.18H, I think, that limits it all to one, all claims to a single policy limit. If you accept that, then we're talking about the single policy limit of 100,000 of State Farm's policy.
Yes, sir.
And you want to access that because the language is somehow, in quotes, convoluted. No malice aforethought. But why not say that you divide up that $100,000 between the beneficiaries on the A2 language, amount available for payment?
Yeah, absolutely, we can say that. That would be the worst case scenario if you assume, Your Honor, that this policy language is not ambiguous and is clear and concise. If you assume that, then there is one per person limit available of 100. The set-offs would apply for the wrongful death recoveries already made of the beneficiaries, and you would divide up an additional 100,000 minus the recoveries already made. I agree. However,
and we have four or five of those cases before us.
Yes. And Latrell, I believe, would be one of them.
It is.
That is absolutely the case, Your Honor. But in addition to that, there is not, we believe, that under the facts of this case and the language of this policy that's before the court this morning, there is not $100,000 in UIM benefits still available. There is $200,000. Because 100 has been paid for the one claim which is for injury, that is the decedent's death. That's the only party in this case among the insured persons who sustained a bodily injury. 100 minus 100, that's gone. There's $200,000 more, though, based on the per occurrence limits, unless this policy, as written, is unambiguous, clear and concise, and effectively consolidates the claims of all the wrongful death beneficiaries who are insured persons. And that's the issue here as far as the $200,000.
Per occurrence, define per occurrence for me. How do you define occurrence?
Occurrence is the accident.
The accident. So there's 200, where do you get 200,000? I can see 100,000.
Because,
additional, but.
Yes, Your Honor. Under definition 1C, the beneficiaries of the deceased are all insured persons as defined. And in fact, 3937-18A provides that coverage has to be offered for those people having damages due to wrongful death or arising from wrongful death. Okay, so what happens is 100 has been paid for the person that had the injury. There are multiple limits still available, 200 more because the policy is 100, 300. And we believe that this language does not unambiguously limit to the per person. It limits to the per occurrence or per accident. And there's more than one, obviously more than one covered insured person who is entitled to collect damages due to or arising from the wrongful death of the deceased in this case.
You know this case better than I do, obviously, but you just established the proposition that the first 100,000 was paid. That's not so, is it?
The first 100,000 was paid by the tortfeasor.
That's correct, but we're not talking about a tortfeasor's policy. We're talking about an uninsured motorist policy of 100,000, 300,000, where nothing has been paid.
Well, Your Honor,
isn't that right?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
But we would have to then apply basically Savoy, which I believe Senate Bill 20 probably does, has taken care of, so to speak, that we were to allow $300,000 now available, in other words, on top of the 100 already paid. We had raised that in our brief, the amicus brief didn't raise that issue.
So under Senate Bill 20, probably what you're saying is, if we agree with you that the language is not a barrier to your recovery, you still have the deduction from the first 100 that was spread out among these claimants from the primary liability carrier. leaving 200 exposed under your best case scenario.
That's exactly. There would be a set off to the individual wrongful death beneficiaries who did receive part of the initial $100K. Correct.
If I understood your answer to Justice Douglas, the initial $100K went to entirely the group of claimants that you represented.
That is correct. The insured persons as defined by the policy.
You have less than 2 minutes.
This policy, Your Honors, is ambiguous. It is not, if you even analyze it in peri materia, it's still ambiguous. The portion of the limits of liability, which is a portion that the appellee has to rely on, do not effectively limit these wrongful death claims to a per person $100,000 recovery. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Trimble. Mr. Smith.
Good morning. May it please this honorable court, opposing counsel. My name is Matthew Smith, and I have the privilege this morning of representing Mid-Century Insurance Company before Your Honors. Mr. Justice Douglas, I think it's important to address first your concern about the facts of the underlying case, because I'm not sure that they are clear here this morning when they need to be. It was undisputed in the trial court below that James Cartelli was insured by State Farm Insurance with $100,000 limits. The estate of Shane Parker, which under the wrongful death statute of the state of Ohio, is the only party that can bring a wrongful death claim, collected and received, prior to the decision in this case, the entire $100,000 limits available under the tort user's policy. The trial court, the Second District Court of Appeal, both clearly distinguish the auto owners versus Fox case on that basis that had been previously decided by the Second District Court of Appeal. Here we have a situation where the undisputed facts are that the tortfeasor, James Cartelli, was insured, and that insurance company, State Farm, paid the full limits. It's further undisputed before this court today that those limits matched exactly the Mid-Century limits. And in the post-Senate Bill 20 era, those limits are offset from the amount of coverage available to the tortfeasor, leading to zero recovery. And that is what the trial court through Judge Langer and the Second District Court of Appeal clearly held. And as I would submit to this court, the law of the state of Ohio effective September 20th, 1994, and through the present relative to the settlements. Now, something that the court did not address is that there was an additional remedy available to the Clark family members, and that is under the board decision of this court, and that they had the right to go to their own individual UIM carriers and submit a claim for emotional distress injuries. And this court has recognized that anymore. We don't go there here. Here the issue was the estate of Shane Parker, and that was the sole and only claimant, and that estate claimed the $100,000 from the tortfeasor, leaving zero left to recover under the Mid-Century policy.
Can I respectfully disagree that that's the law of Ohio, given the Andrews case that was decided by majority of this court and a substantial majority some time ago? Let's assume for purposes of argument, I agree absolutely with what you've said with regard to Senate Bill 20 and single policy limit.
Okay.
So all the claims are rolled into one, notwithstanding what he argued. That still leaves us with 3937.18A2. Amount available for payment, doesn't it?
Which clearly does not result in a situation here any different than what the trial court and the court of appeal.
Well, it does on policy limit versus policy limit. Amount available for payment, because this $100,000 from the tortfeasor was divided up 23, 19, in four different ways, as I recall it.
Well, that was divided up by a different court.
I understand. The probate court.
The probate court.
I understand. But the point is, each of those people who were insured got less than their policy, a single policy limit for all of their claims in their uninsured motorist coverage. And what does the language amount available for payment mean if it doesn't mean amount that you actually recover?
What the language available for payment means is the claimant presenting the claim. In this case, under the laws of the state of Ohio and the Wrongful Death Act, there was only one claimant that presented the claim, and that was the estate of Jane Park.
Oh, but that's always the case. Under the right case, you have to do that. The fiduciary has to bring it, but he brings it on behalf of all of them. We recognize they're all separate causes of action.
But legally, under the laws of the state of Ohio, those individual claimants had no right to claim under this policy on behalf of the estate. They had to bring the claim through the estate. And there has never been a decision from this court or any court of the state of Ohio that has abrogated that, that any claim for wrongful death must be brought solely and exclusively in the name of the estate. What the trial court determined is that the estate was the true party in interest. The estate collected the $100,000 from State Farm. Thereafter, the trial court had nothing to do with the distribution. The distribution was handled by the probate court. The issue is, who could collect under the mid-century policy and who could collect under the State Farm policy? The individual recipients who actually received the money from the death of Shane Parker had no legal standing to sue James Cartelli. The estate had a legal standing to sue James Cartelli and did for their collective benefit. Then, when you take the amount of the settlement and offset it from the available limits for UM/UI coverage, is where the provisions of Senate Bill 20 apply and the set-off occurs.
You're saying there was no liability for Scarpelli to the wrongful death beneficiaries?
I'm saying the individual recipients of the money could not individually sue James Cartelli.
You say there's no liability of Scarpelli to the individual death beneficiaries?
Just make sure what I'm saying is clear.
Just because I understand the argument, I think. I've never heard it before.
Claim under the State Farm policy only through the estate.
Yeah, I understand that, but that's by statute.
That's correct.
But that same statute, what is it, 2125.02 B or D, I think, goes on and says, however, each of the wrongful death beneficiaries are assumed to have suffered injury.
That's correct.
Which gives them a claim.
Under the laws of the estate.
Through the estate bringing it.
The issue is, would they have legal standing to file a lawsuit against James Cartelli? And the clear answer is no. There is not a single court of Ohio, nor this honorable court, that has ever held otherwise.
Counsel, I guess what's troubling me is you were here probably to the case before, which counsel suggested some common sense.
Thank you.
That's what's troubled me about this whole arena for so long. It seems to me that this court struggles trying to get some common sense, and everybody wants to paint word boxes, and we try to maybe break out of those boxes to achieve what seems to us maybe be common sense results. We have all of that, but we're engaged in a word game. Justice Douglas's point is to get this money. I mean, we talk about what the exposure is, but to get this money, one has to demonstrate injury and loss on the part of each one of these individuals at some point. I mean, after you agree what's available in the box, or what the exposure is, to get any of it out of the box, you have to demonstrate loss by individual claimants. You bring that in the name of the estate. But to get access, to get any of the money, you have to show injury of those individuals. I think that's the point Justice Douglas is. And then the issue becomes, what does the Ohio General Assembly permit in terms of looking at that recovery? We do not have a system in the state of Ohio, never have, until the law changes, never will, where individual recipients of wrongful death benefits are judged to have suffered their part claims other than through the estate. That is clear. And Mr. Justice Spiker, you mentioned, how do you bring common sense to this? I'm actually glad you mentioned that, because I think there is a way for this court to do that on many of these insurance issues. And that's to take an approach that this court does not, but other states have. And that's to analyze the policy language as if we roll back the clock to the day before the accident. If you look at this policy as of October 15, 1996, the day before the unfortunate death of James Parker, had Cheryl Clark or any other claimant read this policy, what would they have expected? That's the test to use if you don't apply common sense. And when you do that, if you look at had this policy been reviewed the day before the loss, because any policy can be construed and misconstrued after a loss occurs to fund coverage. But if you look at it reasonably the day before, what did this policy say?
I mean, with no disrespect, wouldn't you expect to ask her to go to bed shortly after you
No, Your Honor. That is what brings a common sense approach to insurance law. If you look at the policy as what would the parties have felt before the loss occurred, then you apply common sense. If you try to convolute the language to find coverage after a loss occurs, anybody can do that. We have to look at the reasonable expectation 24 hours or even an hour before the death of Shane Parker. And if you do that fairly, look at this policy. What counsel fails to address is that the term bodily injury is clearly defined in this case. Bodily injury is defined in the mid-century policy as meaning bodily injury to or sickness, disease, or death of any person. Now, it's convenient to ignore that after the fact when it helps you. But this policy clearly and unambiguously stated claims for bodily injury include death claims. Then you look beyond that to say, what does the policy say then about what the limits are for those wrongful death claims arising out of that bodily injury? And if you look at the policy, under definition 1C, which the amicus brief fully ignores, what the definition of an insured is any person for damages that person is entitled to recover because of bodily injury to you, and then the key language, or a family member. Now, Shane Parker was a family member of Cheryl Clark as the named insured. Accordingly, everyone who had the right to make a claim as an insured under the policy is defined and has the right to recover due to the death of a family member, here Shane Parker. Here it is undisputed, the bodily injury was the death, and that is a defined term under the policy. So it's easy to say that there's an ambiguity, but there is not when you read the contract in paramateria with the definition of bodily injury, the definition under the UMUIN section of who is an insured, which includes anyone making a claim as a result of the death of a family member. And then you look at the clear and unambiguous language of the limitations to the single per person limit. Now it's easy for me to say that, standing here having a client that I represent. That's self-serving. What I think this court needs to look at is not simply that Matthew Smith or his injury argues this, but that three separate appellate courts sitting in this state have all interpreted the exact same language that we're here to discuss today. In three separate decisions, Gambert versus Cobb, Palpendale versus Farmers Insurance of Columbus Incorporated, and this case, the Second District Court of Appeals and the Sixth District Court of Appeals have interpreted this language as being clear and unambiguous and limiting recovery to a single per-person limit.
Now, are you talking about the mid-century language?
Yes, yes, Mr. Justice Resnick. The language that's interpreted in those three decisions is identical to the language this court is called upon to interpret today. So as you sit here, looking at the law of the state of Ohio, you have three appellate courts that have already interpreted this language and said there is no ambiguity, the single per-person limit applies.
This is a conflict case, isn't it?
Yes.
The only somebody court, must have done something different.
The only court of appeal in this state that has ever ruled otherwise on this language was the 5th District in 1992 in Farmers Insurance versus Atkinson. Now, we've argued a number of issues here today. A number of issues are argued in the appellant's brief. Other issues have been brought up by Mr. Justice Douglas. The only issue that this court accepted jurisdiction on, however, is whether or not a conflict exists between the 2nd and the 6th districts and the 5th district in light of the Atkinson decision. I would respectfully submit to you, no such conflict of interest exists. First, we have to look at the Atkinson case in historic perspective. That case was decided after this case decided Wood, after this court decided Wood versus Shepard. The Atkinson decision was decided in 1992, and at that point, Senate Bill 20 and the amendments to 3937-18 were not even thought of yet. So in an historical context, the Atkinson decision was decided upon issues of law that are no longer valid in the state of Ohio. And in fact, if you look at the Atkinson decision, what the Fifth District itself says, it based its decision on erosion after that decision came down. To specifically quote the Atkinson court, they said, because the claims in this case arise out of the 1982 modifications to the wrongful death statute, we distinguish the above two cases, and they were referring to Gambert and Hapidal. So they distinguished those two cases on the basis of the 1982 modifications to wrongful death. Then the Fifth District said it would require the Supreme Court to overrule Wood versus Shepard to eliminate the distinction between derivative claims such as loss of services and consortium and statutorily created claims for wrongful death damages. So the Fifth District itself said if Wood versus Shepard goes away, our decision goes away in its entirety. Now what the Fifth District did not receive was that this court would not do away with Wood versus Shepard, but that the Ohio General Assembly, effective October 20th of 1994, would have the same effect by modifying 3937-18H of the Ohio Revised Code. Because that's exactly what did occur when the Senate Bill 20 provision changes came into law in the state of Ohio, is that the undergirding principles behind the Atkinson decision washed away as the Fifth District predicted that it might. And if this court looks at the Second District Court of Appeal in this case opinion, it clearly addresses that very clearly. I see that my time is up, and thank you, Justices.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Trimble, you've almost used your time. Take 30 seconds if you want.
Thank you, Judge. Your Honors, it doesn't matter what statute applies to this case. This is still a case involving contract interpretation and whether or not the language in this particular contract is subject to different analyses and evaluations and whether it's ambiguous or not. We submit it certainly is ambiguous. The other important point is this. As to that example of October 15, 1996, if the insured in this case actually would sit down, would have sat down and read her policy, she would have found the definition of insured person, and she would have looked at being defined then as entitled to recover damages, and she then would have looked at the limits of the policy that she had, 100 per person, 300 per occurrence, and she would have said that I didn't get 100, my husband didn't get 100, Shane's father didn't get 100, my two children, Shane's siblings didn't get 100. Nobody got 100. And this policy does not limit these aggregate claims to the per person limit under the policy.
Thank you, Mr. Trimble. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.